Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the newest evidence for targeted therapies and immunotherapy to treat advanced non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Justin Gaynor, Julia Roto, and Urs Weber will discuss data for some of the newest drugs for non-small cell lung cancer harboring a ROS1 or RET fusion, as well as emerging KRAS-targeting drugs and immunotherapies. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from BioNTech, Iovance Biotherapeutics, Inc., Lilly, Nuvation Bio, Revolution Medicines, Inc., and Rigel Pharmaceuticals. In the first segment, Dr. Gaynor reviews data for the latest ROS1 and RET inhibitors.
So I want to transition now to ROS1. So ROS1 fusions, less common. These are 1-2% of patients. This is largely a historical context now, but I did want to just run through all of the approved agents. So crizotinib was the first agent approved here. One caveat is, crizotinib is a better ROS1 inhibitor than it is an ALK inhibitor. And another point to make is that not all ALK inhibitors are ROS1 inhibitors. Important point there. So alectinib is not a ROS1 inhibitor. So old study, response rate 72%, median PFS 19.2 months. We now have more dedicated ROS1 inhibitors. Here we're showing entrectinib. This was the second agent approved for ROS1. You can see this study, this analysis combined multiple studies together, put together an objective response rate of 68%, median PFS of 15.7 months. One advantage, a little bit more CNS penetrance, right, compared to crizotinib. The downside, though, is the TRK-related side effects that we see with entrectinib, and this is something that's going to come up as we talk about various agents, because TRK, right, can give us a lot of those side effects that we don't like, dizziness, weight gain, things like that. Like the experience with ALK, we've come to understand how resistance develops for ROS1. These are very, very similar kinases, so there's a lot of homology between the two. And so what we've learned is, just like there was that ALK G1202R mutation, there's a homologous mutation called G2032R in ROS1. Is probably the one you have to really remember. And this is one of the main mediators of resistance to things like crizotinib. More recently, we've seen the emergence of newer agents such as repotrectinib. Again, it also has TRK effects. But Alex Drillin and colleagues had published work with repotrectinib showing a response rate close to 80%. And I think here we're really starting to move the needle in terms of progression-free survival, right? So seeing a median PFS close to 3 years in the study. And so I think this then kind of leapfrogged the prior agents. And importantly, unlike what I've shown you so far, this agent also has some activity against that resistance mutation, G2032R. So small numbers, but the response rate was 59% in patients with that alteration. And then to round things out in terms of other approved agents, talotrectinib, you can see here, just based on this waterfall plot, right, very impressive response rate here. And we also saw responses in that G2032R mutation, so about 60% of patients responding. And this agent does have the longest median PFS. I know it's probably hard to see, but we're talking about a median PFS of around 45 months. One of our senior fellows, Sarah Waliani, put together this nice summary of this data, she broke it down. On the left is TKI naive, on the right is TKI pretreated. On the x-axis there, it's the PFS and in terms of months, and then the response rate on the y-axis. So I think that's like, you can see here that really taletrectinib and repotrectinib are differentiated between these two. The middle column is the intracranial response rates. Also, you know, we see that these agents, granted small numbers, these are for patients with measurable disease, but still striking. And then on the bottom portion, this is looking at incidence of treatment-related adverse events with a focus on TRK-related effects. And so I think this, you know, if we think about repotrectinib and taletrectinib, I think where they're differentiated is somewhat on those TRK-related effects, where we see lower rates of things like dizziness, dysgeusia, with taletrectinib compared to repotrectinib. So if you're using an approved agent, you know, I tend to use taletrectinib in that context. There are newer agents coming down the pike. This is not approved yet, but NVL-520. This is a newer ROS1 inhibitor that is TRK sparing, which has shown really significant activity in previously treated patients. Also has activity against that resistance mutation. So something to keep an eye on. And then rounding things out for RET fusions around the same frequency as ROS1, we saw data from selpercatinib earlier today, but just to review the data from the metastatic setting. So this is the Libretto-001 study. Showed responses, high response rates in both the treatment naive and previously treated. And then in a randomized phase 3 against chemo plus or minus pembrolizumab, showing an improvement in PFS, really solidifying selective RET TKIs as standards of care. We have a parallel agent in pralsetinib, likewise was developed around the same time. They have many of the same properties. High response rates in previously treated and treatment naive patients. Both of these agents, when you look at kind of the impact that they have on overall survival in terms of timelines, have median OS close to 4 years for both of these agents. So we are moving the needle in terms of long-term outcomes for these patients. And then what we just saw, Sanjay Popat presented a couple days ago, the randomized phase 3 for pralsetinib. Here the comparison was chemo plus or minus pembrolizumab, so very similar to the selpercatinib data and selpercatinib trial. And we see here, again, a separation in the curves with an improvement in PFS, really solidifying what we expected from the phase 1-2 data.
In the next segment, Dr. Roto discusses emerging therapies for KRAS mutant non-small cell lung cancer.
So this is a list of kind of some of the major classes of types of KRAS inhibitors you might be encountering as you're hearing new things come out. The first one is our G12C selective KRAS off-state inhibitors. This is our current ones. This is adagrasib and sotorasib. These found a way to bind to this particular binding pocket in KRAS's inactive state, its GDP-bound state. So this is once it's already finished doing its action on GTP, it's GDP, it's turned off, and the drugs can bind. And this is the initial trick that allowed KRAS to become actionable, and this is why we have things like sotorasib and adagrasib, and many of our other emerging generations of novel KRAS G12C inhibitors you might be hearing about, like divarasib, olomorasib, and others. The next thing we have, I think the other key category that you're going to hear a lot about in the coming years are these on-state inhibitors. And these are drugs that are managing binding to KRAS in its GTP-bound state. That's its active state, its on-state. And they do it via a really unique mechanism where they use a chaperone protein to create a binding interaction. There are other additional novel agents that I won't focus on as much, but I want to mention them. There are these dual state inhibitors that try to bind both to off and on to try to increase potency, so hitting both states simultaneously. There's the pan-RAS inhibitors, which really leverage multiple of these different sort of binding strategies to achieve their interactions, and we'll hear about at least one of them. You know, we heard about it in the plenary today. There's the mutation-specific non-G12C inhibitors. this was tough. G12C, you can bind covalently to that cysteine. That's an active agent to bind to. But G12V, G12D, these are common in other solid tumors, less common in lung cancer, but they're harder to make something stick to them. But now we're seeing emerging mutation-specific inhibitors that I think are going to be important in clinical practice. And I won't touch on KRAS degraders, but there are other things being done to try to not just turn it off, but simply degrade it so it's not around in the cell doing its purpose. Most of the time I want to spend on emerging KRAS drugs, because you are going to hear a lot about all these things sort of flooding the space of what we're thinking about in KRAS. So I want to give you a framework to think about them. So first, I listed some of the investigational KRAS G12C off inhibitors. So these are things that work a lot like sotorasib or adagrasib, but try to bind more potently or try to spare wild type KRAS more effectively. And again, they're binding that off state. I'm going to highlight a few that have the most mature data. I can't possibly cover them all, though there's all have a lot of interesting data going on within them. I think divarasib has been our front runner here. It's the one you'll hear the most about. Again, it's a G12C specific KRAS inhibitor. And it has shown its sort of single arm studies thus far response rate over 50%. So that's better than the 30% I just showed you before. The PFS over a year, 13.1 months, better than the under 6 month PFS as I showed you before. It does have some toxicities, but low rates of grade 3 or 4 toxicity, so likely manageable in clinical practice. And there is indeed, this is one of the only drugs that has a true randomized phase 3 study in previously treated setting, just going right up against sotorasib or adagrasib saying, is this better or not? And that study has been ongoing. So we'll have actual randomized data comparing these in the future. Olmorasib is also fairly long in development. I'm going to show this slide quickly, which is its single agent activity in lung cancer, response rates in the kind of 30s to 40%, depending on the series you look at. PFS sitting around a little over 6 months as well here. But I think what's interesting and why I included it here was thinking about the question, can we sequence some of these newer KRAS inhibitors after patients who already got adagrasib, sotorasib, because so many patients are currently receiving them, what happens? This is what happens if you gave olmorasib after one of the original G12C inhibitors, and you still see activity, response rates at or a little above 40%. And you can see, I like they broke it down by those who stopped for toxicity versus those who stopped for disease progression, actually both showing activity here. This is just a list of some of the other G12C off inhibitors with some of the response rates and PFSs that have been reported. My takeaway is that this next kind of crop of G12C inhibitors are starting to hit 50% plus response rates, starting to hit PFSs again closer to 8 to 9 or even closer to 12 months along the way. So we're showing some increased activity with newer agents in this space. Now, I'll highlight elisrasib. It's a challenge for me to say all these tonight, so I'm so sorry. Elisrasib, which had some data at ASCO. So this is from the conference here. Just pointing out again, here, monotherapy, first-line non-small cell lung cancer. Response rate, 78%, PFS a year. This is a lot better. Again, looking cross-trial, these are small numbers, but these are getting to be really meaningful numbers for our patients looking for something oncogene-targeted. All right, going to RAS tri-complex inhibitors. This is, I think, a really interesting novel category of KRAS inhibitors. It encompasses both mutation-specific RAS inhibitors, so G12C-specific, G12D-specific, but also, of course, the pan-RAS inhibitor, daraxonrasib, just saw in the plenary for pancreatic cancer, showing improvements in overall survival. And these bind a really, I think, interesting way. So what they do is they bind to the chaperone protein, cyclophilin A, which lets them attach to the GTP bound, the on form of KRAS. This creates a big complex that prevents binding with downstream effectors, and in doing so, can inhibit signaling even in more difficult binding capacity. So this is how these tri-complex inhibitors work. They make these big tri-complexes that just cannot signal effectively. So we'll talk first about the G12C-specific on inhibitor. This is elironrasib. Again, these are showing activity. This is another potent kind of G12C-directed agent, response rate over 50%, PFS short of a year. I'll also show this data. So looking at what if you sequence RAS inhibitors with different mechanisms of action, this is going to come up, right? You're going to have patients coming off adagrasib, sotorasib. Maybe you're looking for a clinical trial. Maybe you're thinking about things that become available in the future in practice. These agents do seem to have some activity for patients who are coming off those drugs. So here you're seeing response rate 42% after prior G12C and a PFS of 6 months. That's not bad. That's what we're seeing in the frontline setting for KRAS inhibitors right now. Daraxonrasib, I think, will be of interest because of the data we just saw today. So this is the lung cancer data for daraxonrasib. This is, again, it's a pan-RAS inhibitor. It was studied for G12X non-small cell lung cancer, so all the various different G12-something mutations. And you can see that's a waterfall plot showing a lot of activity. Response rate was officially for 38%, but a lot of decreases in disease burden and a meaningful PFS. So again, as a pan-RAS inhibitor, we're seeing activity. It does come with some toxicities, particularly things like rash or GI toxicity. So this is an agent that likely would require, you know, attention to supportive care when using it, but certainly meaningful clinical activity. And there's a randomized phase 3 study ongoing here against docetaxel in the later line setting. All right, I want to talk about G12D next. And I think if I had to guess what's going to add next to the NCCN guidelines as an actionable therapeutic driver in lung cancer, I'm going to guess G12D. That's me speculating. You know, this is one of our less common KRAS mutations in lung cancer. It's about 4% of non-small cell lung cancer. That's the same percent as ALK. And this is interesting. It's very different than other KRAS inhibitors. It has enrichment for people with never smoking or light tobacco use history. And in fact, when you're sequencing never smokers or light smokers and you're looking for EGFR or ALK, you're actually going to sometimes find KRAS G12D as their driver mutation. And for a long time now, we've found it in these young non-smokers. It's been bad news. We cannot do anything about it. It's not EGFR. It's not ALK. It's not these others, ROS1. Now we're going to have agents that can target it. So here I'll highlight zoldonrasib, which is a G12D-specific RAS inhibitor. It's one of the tri-complex on inhibitors. It's how it binds. And this is its monotherapy data. You know, response rate 61%. Disease control rate was high. I didn't put it there, but you can see it on the waterfall plot. This is an effective, at least in response rate, agent for these patients. And it's an oral agent. So I tersely predict that in the future, we'll be treating KRAS G12D with these sort of targeted agents, much like we do a lot of our other drivers, including in our non-smoking lung cancer population. I'll highlight from ASCO, there was a second G12D inhibitor. It's one of the dual state inhibitors that was presented. So again, binding on and off. And this showed some nice activity. I think I got it in. Yes, I managed to get it in. And showed some really interesting response rates as well, very high activity. And I think, again, the idea that we're having this really flood of drugs showing a lot of activity in KRAS, this is great news for our KRAS patients, but we're going to have to choose amongst them at some point as they all become available.
In the final segment, Dr. Weber discusses the data for emerging immunotherapies to treat non-small cell lung cancer.
We do see these patients who have really wonderful long-term responses to checkpoint inhibition, which is amazing. But unfortunately, most patients are not going to get that really nice long-term benefit from immune checkpoint inhibition. And so thinking about, you know, what else can we do, you know, can we incorporate things like KEAP1 and STK11 into our decision making? Can they help drive treatment decisions? Where do we kind of go from here? And so that's where we kind of get to some of these novel therapies. And so here is a nice schematic kind of illustrating our understanding to this point of kind of how cancer cells interact with cells in our immune system that actually could, you know, kill them. Like T cells, like NK cells, and you know PD-1 and CTLA-4 are part of that equation, but there's certainly other things that are involved in that interaction. And this is kind of a nice summary of sort of all the things we know about and things that, you know, we've developed therapies for. I'm certainly not going to cover all the therapies on this slide. I will focus a lot here on the anti-PD-L1 VEGF bispecifics. It's kind of a flavor of the season if you've attended the lung sessions here at this ASCO meeting and even looking at some of the posters. You know, there are a lot of these floating around. The one that is the furthest along in development at this point is ivonescimab, and we saw that being talked about in a plenary session today with the Harmony 6 overall survival data. Harmony 2 was a study looking at ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab as a first-line treatment for patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer who were PD-L1 positive, so any expression greater than 1%. This is a study that was done in China, and it showed improved median PFS with ivonescimab pretty impressive difference there. And the benefit was seen both in the PD-L1 high and sort of the PD-L1 intermediate populations. There are immune-mediated toxicities from ivonescimab, and there are also, as was highlighted in the presentation today, there are AEs specific to the VEGF inhibition that we do need to be mindful of. Harmony 3 is an ongoing study looking at essentially challenging KEYNOTE-189 in the first line setting. So this is somewhat akin to the Harmony 6 study that we saw presented, although the Harmony 6 study was focused on squamous cell lung cancer. But in Harmony 3, which is a global study of platinum doublet chemo with ivonescimab versus platinum doublet chemo with pembro for advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and that study is ongoing. Harmony 7, which is another global study that is ongoing, is looking at ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab as a first-line treatment, specifically in patients with high PD-L1 expression, so kind of challenging the KEYNOTE-24 supremacy in the first-line setting for those patients. We saw data from Rosetta Lung 02 here at ASCO. So this is another similar bispecific antibody. The caveat here that this targets PD-L1 and not PD-1 in addition to VEGF. And this is being looked at as a first-line treatment for advanced non-small cell lung cancer. So Solange Peters presented this data. Here's kind of a schematic of how this bispecific antibody interacts with T cells and cancer cells. And here they were looking at, you know, non-squamous and squamous histology, looking at pemetrexed, which again is this bispecific in combination with chemotherapy at sort of different dose levels. And what they saw really nice responses, so definitely some activity here. They highlighted the 1,400 milligram dose because that's the dose that they're going to be taking into the phase 3 study. But what's also nice to see is that you do see responses across the different levels of PD-L1 expression. Granted, these are small numbers, and there does still seem to be that trend towards, you know, better responses with higher levels of PD-L1 expression. But you do, you know, they do still report objective response rate of a confirmed objective response rate of almost 50% in the patients who did not have any PD-L1 expression. I think one caveat here, the follow-up here is still relatively immature. So I think it sort of remains to be seen how durable those responses are. It did look like, you know, at least initially, there was some durability, but, you know, I think it's going to be important to kind of see this more long-term and see how much of this was the chemotherapy that the patients got versus, you know, how much long-term disease control are you really getting, especially in the PD-L1 low patients. And as I alluded to, the phase 3 portion of this trial is recruiting, so we'll see more data with this agent coming down the pike. Rosetta Lung 202, another ongoing study in this space, looking at pemetrexed versus pembro as a first-line treatment for PD-L1 high. So again, kind of challenging that KEYNOTE-24 paradigm as sort of our first-line treatment for patients who are PD-L1 high. Another one of these bispecifics that we saw presented yesterday was PF-4404. This is against an anti-PD-1 VEGF bispecific. Again, looking at first-line treatment, non-small cell lung cancer, any PD-L1 positivity. Here we're looking at sort of just different dose levels with this agent, and again, seeing pretty nice responses. Definitely activity here with a confirmed OR around 68%. So we'll certainly be hearing more about this agent as well. And again, small numbers here, but it does appear that you are seeing better responses in PD-L1 high patients, but you are still seeing some, not just some, you're seeing a good response rate, 62% in most patients who have intermediate PD-L1 positivity. No PD-L1 0% patients in this study. The PRESERVE-003 study, another study that we got data on a little bit earlier this year, this is looking at gotistobart, which is a novel anti-CTLA-4 antibody. The idea here is that this antibody is actually pH sensitive and binds to CTLA-4 preferentially in the tumor microenvironment and not so much generally throughout the body. And so in PRESERVE-003, we're looking at gotistobart versus docetaxel as a second line treatment in squamous non-small cell lung cancer. And you know, PFS was not significantly improved, although you know, numerically it looks a little bit better. And then overall survival, there was actually an improvement long term with this agent. So also something that we're going to be hearing more about. I want to highlight lifileucel or LN-145, which is an autologous TIL. That was studied in patients with refractory metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. What you can see here is, you know, definitely some nice responses. Definitely, you know, also a good number of patients with stable disease. So getting some disease control. And you, in terms of the treatment emergent adverse events, you see, you know, the kind of things that we think about with cytokine release syndrome. So fevers, hypotension. Those sorts of things. And there's ongoing exploration of this agent in the IOV LEON-202 and IUV COM-202 studies. Here's the design of the LEON-202 study looking at you know, patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer who are post-checkpoint inhibitor therapy, and then looking at a couple of different cohorts here, stratified by you know, PD-L1 status, and you know, this is really aimed at, you know, these patients who have progressed on checkpoint inhibitor who have a high need. This kind of is similar to the first slide that I showed, but kind of walking through the process of what it takes to actually get TIL therapy into a patient. Kind of starting with, you know, identifying the right patients, getting the tumor tissue, expanding those lymphocytes, and then sort of the actual treatment part where patients go through a conditioning regimen, cytoreductive conditioning regimen, and then get their TIL infusion, get observed in the hospital. And so really kind of like a multi-week prep process, and then you know, a hospitalization that, again, you know, I think really should be at a center that has sort of the expertise with these cellular therapies. And again, here's some preliminary results from LUN-202. So again, seeing objective response rate of 26%. Again, very small numbers at this point, but definitely activity here. Decent, you know, durations of responses in, again, a small number of patients, but a couple of patients here who, you know, again, in the IO refractory setting are getting, you know, a year out of this therapy, which is great. And then, you know, here in cohort 3A, we're going to be looking at combining this agent with a checkpoint inhibitor, with pembrolizumab. And again, you know, so far seeing some encouraging early signals here with a small number of patients. The last thing I really briefly want to bring up is CAR T. So this is related, but not the same. So here, you're not resecting a patient's tumor. You're pheresing T cells out of a patient's blood, and then essentially reprogramming the chimeric antigen receptor in those T cells to target something that you want those T cells to go after, and then you know, you expand them and you know, put the patient through sort of a similar conditioning regimen, and then infuse them back. And the idea is, you know, that those T cells will then go after an antigen of your choosing that is sort of localized on the tumor. And again, same thing as with TILs. You know, there's unique toxicities with these therapies. The logistics are you know, very particular, and so definitely something that should be happening at a center of its expertise with these therapies. There is sort of some early work going on, not in humans yet, but in the lab looking at some of these constructs. And so this was looking at a TROP2 targeted CAR T in EGFR mutant lung cancer after osimertinib. So they essentially were taking these, taking advantage of the fact that they noticed a lot of TROP2 overexpression in post OC folks, and then were treating these mice with a TROP2 targeted CAR T, and saw some really nice responses, at least in the mice. So the orange line here is the osimertinib in combination with a TROP2 CAR T, and so I think this is something that people are working on. My colleague Kyle Kincannon at University of Colorado is working on this type of thing with CAR Ts in the EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer space. So this is something that we could very well start seeing in humans in the coming years.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.